for our ongoing partnership with SAMI. So again, we're here for the Design and Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites webinar on successful remedial design. This is session number one. Now, before we jump into that technical presentation, I just wanted to highlight that this is being offered to you through an ongoing EPA SAMI collaboration, where they have some primary objectives of facilitating open information exchange between professionals from the private and public sectors, as well as helping to encourage a forum for these technical presentations and encourage communication across networks. Now, many of you may be familiar with the Design and Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites symposiums that are held twice a year, East and West. And so we've done them virtually this year. And I think they're hoping to be back in person later on for their fall delivery for the West. But they are also working with us here on Cluin to host a regular series of online webinars so that all can participate. So I will just remind everybody that we have a number of webinars planned as part of that partnership. So we are doing two webinars today for their May deliveries, and then we'll have two additional ones in July and then another one in September. So we encourage you to visit the DCHWS website to learn more about previous events and future sessions. And I did mention that we have things coming up in July as part of that partnership. So I will walk through this reminder at the end as well, but I do hope you can join us on July 14th because we'll be offering two back-to-back sessions that day and we'll be opening registration for those events very soon. So I think that that is the end of the technical reminders that I have. And I'm gonna go ahead and turn off my screen share and get ready to turn it over to our first speaker to begin the presentation today. So Terry, I'll encourage you to go ahead and open up your screen share and I'll confirm when we can see the slides on your end. And they are up and they look great. So let me go ahead and turn it over to you to get started.
Wonderful, thank you so much. And welcome everybody. My name is Terry McMillan. I am a senior geologist and I work for EA Engineering Science and Technology. I'm located in their Albuquerque, New Mexico office. And I have 24 years experience in the consultant industry, and that includes some time as being a regulator as well. And as Gina said, today I'm going to give you a presentation on site assessment, design consideration, and performance results from an innovative barrier application at a large chlorinated solvent plume site that's in Texas. So my first slide, this is a little bit of background information on the site. The site is located outside of Odessa, Texas. It's located in Ector County. If you're not familiar where Odessa is, it's in West Texas. The site is composed of primarily residential neighborhoods, but it also has commercial property as well. So these areas here are commercial, and then this is commercial, and then this is predominantly all residential property. The contaminants of concern for this site are PCE and CIS-12-DCE, and not as concerning is the TCE. The origination of the release was from here, and it was a release of PCE. This site has multiple zones in the aquifer, and it has numerous private supply wells, and a lot of the private supply wells were impacted. And if you look at my site map here, all of the orange little circles, those are actually private supply wells. This is the sole source of drinking water for this community. So a little bit on the conceptual site model for the site. And I'm gonna start with the subsurface lithology. So at the surface and about down to 55 feet is the Ogallala Formation. It's comprised of caliche, sand, clay, and sandstone. Below that is the Antler Formation, or also known as the Trinity Sand. It's a sandstone and claystone that extends to 140 to 145 feet. This sandstone has variability in its cementation, so there are areas that are well cemented and areas that are not well cemented. And below the face of the Antler Formation is the Dockham Group, so that would be our Triassic red beds. So now on to the water-bearing zones at the site. So the main aquifer at the site is the Trinity Aquifer. And for this site, we have designated three different aquifer zones. And we have the upper sand, the lower sand one, and the lower sand two. And again, below that is our Triassic red bed. Depth to water at this site is about 50 feet below ground surface. So this is the location of our initial release of PCE, and it migrated through the vadose zone and into the upper sand aquifer. As I said, there were numerous supply wells within this area. And these supply wells are screened within predominantly the lower sand 1 aquifer, but also extend into the lower sand 2 aquifer. The supply wells pump from the lower sands and would cause a downward head gradient. As the contamination migrated down gradient in the upper sand, it intersected these private supply wells. Well, the private supply wells have annuluses that are gravel packed. So then the contamination traveled via borehole leakage into the lower sand 1 and the lower sand 2. Now, contamination is the least extensive in the lower sand 2. The contamination is the most extensive in the lower sand 1. And so that is what we're generally going to discuss in this topic today, is we'll be mainly focusing on this unit here. So it's the middle aquifer unit. So let's look at a plume map. And this plume map is of our PCE contamination from February to March 2016. And again, it's in the lower sand 1. So here's our source area. This is our plume. And the PCE plume is about 1,300 feet long. The groundwater flow direction is to the northeast. And as I said earlier, there are private wells screened in the lower sand 1 and lower sand 2. And as a reminder, the orange little circles are all the private supply wells. And you might be wondering how we know where they're screened. Well, we did remove some of the pumps from several of these wells, and we actually geophysically logged them. And we also installed a downhole camera and videoed so we could see where the screen was. And then a lot of the residents in the area actually knew how deep their wells were. And we did realize that some of these wells are screened in the lower sand 1 and a little bit in the lower sand 2, but predominantly they are pulling water from that lower sand 1 aquifer unit.
Sherry, this is Jean. Before you go any further, we've had a report of some background noise. I think it's happening when you're moving your mouse. So I might just advocate that we not use the mouse for just a few slides, and we'll confirm if that's the source of it. Okay?
That would be fine.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have completed a remedial action at the site. And when we did that, we plugged the leaky private supply wells. Some of these wells, the wells that were contaminated, we went ahead and we over-drilled them and we plugged them. And then we also found open boreholes. This is a bedrock formation. So when you drill a hole or a well in this formation, the hole stays open. So historically, a borehole could be left where somebody had pulled the pump and now there's just an open borehole. And we found several of those and we plugged those as well. We then replaced the private supply wells that were contaminated with new private supply wells, and we drilled those deeper into that lower sand too. And we put that in uncontaminated portions of the aquifer so that they would have clean drinking water. The other thing we did was the horizontal SVE system for the source area and the vadose zone. And then we also have been installing in-situ bioremediation and reductive dechlorination by installing permeable reactive barriers. And so the focus of this rest of this talk is going to be on the permeable reactive barriers. So we've installed these in phases at the site. And so if you look at this figure and you look at the little yellow barriers, those are the first barriers that we installed. They were the phase 1 and phase 2 barriers. Those were installed in the upper sand aquifer, so the very first aquifer, and they were installed near the source area. We injected emulsified bulk vegetable oil in these barriers, or EVO. The next barrier that was installed is the orange barrier. This is a phase 3 barrier that we named the Stevenson Avenue Barrier. It was named after the road. And this will be the main focus of our talk today, is this original barrier that we installed. This barrier is a plume stop barrier. After that, we installed the green barriers. Those green barriers are installed in both the lower sand 1 and lower sand 2. And those barriers are comprised of plume stuff and microscale ZVI. And then finally, we installed the pink barriers. And these barriers are plume stop barriers. Okay, so I'm going to go over kind of the challenges with the installation of the barriers. And I'm going to speak in general, but for the most part, it will be a discussion regarding that first plume stop barrier that we installed on Stevenson. And so this is the Stevenson barrier. And the pictures you see here are the Stevenson barrier injection and the drilling and just the final completions. So what I'm gonna talk about, we'll start with placement of the barrier and the injection wells. We'll then talk about well screen placement. We'll talk about vertical profiling in the aquifer. We'll talk about the cementation and fractures. We'll talk about injection issues. And then we'll talk about a temporary increase of contaminant levels that we saw down gradient. So the first thing we'll talk about is the placement of the barriers and the injection wells. So we're back to our same plume map from 2016. And in green there is showing you where we put in the first plume stop barrier in our lower sand one. And we did this to protect those private supply wells. We didn't want the plume to migrate and affect the private supply wells down gradient. So this was a sentinel barrier almost. So the barrier length was 300 feet. It had 24 injection wells. It had 6 performance assessment wells. And the performance assessment wells were placed up gradient and down gradient. So we had wells that we could watch and see what was going into our barrier. And then we had wells down gradient to show us how the barrier was performing. We also used, and I'm gonna use my pointer, sorry, GW207 and GW206. These private supply wells were also used as performance assessment wells. The treatment interval was about 85 feet to 105 feet, and that's where the interval of the lower sand one is present. And we did performance assessment sampling on this first barrier very regularly. We did it for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 120, 180, and 360 days. So plume stop, what is plume stop? If you don't know, plume stop is a liquid activated carbon that absorbs and retards movement of the contamination within the treatment area. And why did we select plume stop? Well, first off, we didn't want to mobilize metals that would impact our private supply wells. With our emulsified vegetable oil barrier that we had in the upper sand close to the source area, we caused reductive dechlorination, reducing conditions, and this caused us to have manganese, iron, and to a lesser extent, arsenic come into solution. The other thing was the longevity. The design for our plume stop barrier was 15 years. With our EVO barriers, we were having to re-inject after 18 months. And then we were having issues maintaining the pH, and we were having to inject sodium bicarbonate to get our pH more to a neutral position. The other was lower analytical costs. With our EVO barriers, we were having to monitor VOCs, metals, total organic carbon, nitrate, sulfate. We were also using a downhole meter to monitor the dissolved oxygen, the oxidation reduction potential, specific conductance, and of course, pH. With our plume stop barrier, we were only gonna have to monitor for VOCs, and we were gonna use passive diffusion bags. So it was definitely a cost savings there. So this is our original design for the barrier. And how we did this design, we used the established radius of influence from our EVO pilot test and the injections that we had done in the upper sand water bearing zone. Now we really felt that the lithology in the upper sand was very similar to the lower sand one. So we felt that that spacing would be appropriate. And our EVO injection well spacing was 20 feet. Regenesis really wanted us to do a pilot test. And if you didn't know, plume stop is a Regenesis product. And we opted to reduce the well spacing of the barrier because it was actually cheaper to install a few more wells than to do the pilot testing. So we installed the barrier, the injection wells, every 12 and a half feet. And then the well screen placement, how we drill in Odessa and at this site is with air rotary. And we had tried previously to drill sonic, but we have never had any success with it in this area. And in fact, we'd only been able to get to about 70 feet. So with the air rotary drilling method, it was kind of difficult to place the screen. We're looking at cuttings and we wanted to be exact with our screen because we wanted to make sure our amendment ended up in the exact place we wanted it to be. So we started using geophysical logging to aid in placement of the well screen. And we logged natural gamma, resistivities, spontaneous potential, conductivity, and caliper. And this is an example of one of the geophysical well logs from one of the injection wells. And as you can see, I have pointed out there where the lower sand one is located. And so we were looking for that interval with our geophysical logs, and we would log every fourth borehole. And then we would literally place our screen specifically. So if it was 12 feet, then we would cut our screen so it was 12 feet. And we'd add and glue and screw our end caps on the end. And that way we had that specific interval for injection. And I will note that because this geophysical logging was so helpful, after this barrier, subsequent barriers, we actually logged every other borehole. Next thing we did was vertical profiling. So once our barrier was in, we installed Eon Products passive diffusion bags at various depth intervals. And this is a picture of one of the passive diffusion bags. We let that sit in our well for about 2 weeks and let it equilibrate, and then we pull it out and sample it. So the results are shown on this cross section, and this is PCE. And at the top, you can see, and I'll use my mouse quietly, I'll try. Injection well 13, this is the well on the north end of the barrier. And then you go all the way down to injection well 36, which is the well on the south end of the barrier. And then you have your depth below ground surface here. Then you have your PCE concentrations, and those are in micrograms per liter. And then the pink is showing where the concentrations were above the MCL. And then the darker pink is where the highest concentrations were. Kind of as expected, we thought that our highest concentrations would be towards the middle to the bottom of the formation of the area that we were looking to treat of the aquifer. But what was unsurprising, we were very surprised that we had concentrations that were below the MCL within our barrier alignment. We were really concerned, so we went ahead and we resampled the middle interval of our passive diffusion bags. And the results confirmed that, yes, we had areas where the concentrations were below the MCL. So we're going to go back to that original plume map. And this is from 2016. And I don't know if when you saw this plume configuration, you thought, oh, that was really strange looking. And we thought that as well. And we could not decide a lot of times whether contamination was coming over here, coming over here. We weren't sure, and it was because we had these two private wells that were below the MCL, and it just wasn't making sense. We had actually pulled the pump from this well, and we had geophysically logged it, and we put a downhole camera in it to determine where the screen was, and it was screened identically to our upgradient monitoring well that was in the lower sand one. So it was screened in the lower sand one. But while the pump was out, we went ahead and took a baler and just did a grab sample just to confirm, just in case where we were sampling at the tap, it was tied into maybe a well we didn't know about. And that also confirmed the results. So now we look at our aerial extent of our baseline PCE concentrations along our Stevenson barrier. And you can see we have clean zones that are noted in the baseline samples along the barrier alignment. It's indicating that we have preferential migration of the plume, and we have differential sedimentation creates these permeability contrasts. The interesting thing is, if we hadn't had wells every 12 feet, we would have never seen this. So it's really kind of cool to actually see this level of detail of our plume. And it kind of was eye-opening. In fact, when we installed the additional barriers up gradient up here, the green barriers, we had the same interfingering. The same thing was going on. And in fact, this area here is even more well-cemented portions. And so the contrast would be even more extreme. And the other thing is we have other sites that are in a similar formation that we've installed wells close apart like this. And it's amazing just the detail, like we were able to see the core of the plume coming through in such detail because of that. So now you know we have these cementation issues, and how is that going to affect our injection? Well, it did infect our injection, as you would think. So areas where we had high injection rates and low pressure is areas that we had poor cementation and our fractures. At another site, we were able to, when we injected and there was a fracture in before we knew it, we had plume stop 30 feet away immediately. And so we had to lower our injection rates to be able to obtain a better coverage. So we had to make sure we decrease the injection rate for that. For areas where we had well cemented, we'd have low permeability and little to no flow. On our Stevenson barrier application, it wasn't so concerning there. We had some cementation, but the cementation didn't affect us to the extent where we didn't have flow. We would have lower flow, but we wouldn't have no flow. But on that green barrier application that was further up gradient, we literally had cementation so strong that we had no flow. So as the injection progressed, also our pressure would rise and we'd increase and the injection rate would decrease. And that's kind of similar with pretty much most injections. That does happen. But we found that if we held our injections to 5 gallons per minute and our pressure to less than 100 PSI, we would have much more success with how quickly we could get the product into the well. And this is a kind of another example of like the cementation just locally within the same street. So if you look at our Stevenson Avenue barrier, you can see that our injection rates are 5 to 16 gallons per minute and the injection pressure was 4 to 77 pounds per square inch. And we were able to inject the full volume in this barrier. But then when we installed the Stevenson Avenue extension barrier just directly north, our injection rates were 1 to 10 gallons per minute and the pressure 10 to 100 PSI. And we had several wells that did not accept the full dose. So just in a short distance, we had such a difference. And you might be asking, so what happens when we aren't able to get the full dose in a well? We actually just inject it in an adjacent well that will take the volume so that we meet our design specifications. Other issues that we had is we had surfacing. This rarely occurred during the initial injection. And this well is interesting. This is injection well 28, and it was the second well that we injected into on the Stevenson barrier. And we had surfacing. And so we had to keep our pressures below 100 PSI. That was kind of a learning moment. I will say that we did the second injections, we did have more frequent surfacing. The other thing we had was we had plume stop go up in one of our upgradient performance assessment wells. There was a preferential pathway to that well. As we injected, plume stop ended up in that well, and our concentrations are non-detect in that well. So it's not a very good assessment well anymore. The other issue we had a temporary increase of contaminant levels down gradient. And I understand that this is not true for every site. And I think Regenesis has stated that most sites this does not occur at, but it did happen here. And if you look, this is the baseline results from 2017. And if you look at GW207, which is a private supply well, the concentrations were below the MCL. But in July 2018, the concentrations had increased to 12.8 micrograms per liter. So we had injected 34,000 gallons of plume stop and water mix, and it appears to have pushed the plume towards this well. And I'm sure the pumping stresses from the well also aided in that. We were sampling on a frequent interval, which was really a good thing because we were able to catch this relatively quickly. And we added a point of use filtration system to this house. And then we did a partial second injection. So I wanted to look at the concentration trends for well GW207. So what you're seeing here is the yellow line is the MCL. And then the black lines that are coming down, the lines here and here, are when we did injections. So this is the baseline injection, and then this is a partial injection we did. You can see that before the baseline, we were below the MCL. Closely to the injection, we came up and down through the MCL and then continued to climb to that 12 micrograms per liter that I showed you previously. And then we started to decrease. Well, we were concerned about this. So what we did was we ended up installing three additional wells upgrading of this area. And I want to point out, we have a performance assessment well here. And soon after, we were able to, our concentrations reduced to below MCLs in the upper two intervals of our passive diffusion bags. But the lower interval never, ever would decrease. So we went back and we looked at the geophysical logs from these wells, and we noted that there seemed to be a small sand interval that we actually did not screen in. And so we went back with these additional wells, three wells that we did upgrading, and we screened those in that deeper interval in that sand to catch that sand and to address this interval as well of this passive diffusion bag. And then after that, our concentrations decreased, and by September 2019, we were below the MCL for PCE. Well, we were very excited. Look, we have MW58 is now all below the MCL. Our private supply well is back in business and below the MCL, but then now we had issues on the southern end of our barrier. So this is a concentration trend map for MW59. And you can see the three different intervals, the concentrations of PCE, the initial injection, and our concentrations all dropped below the MCLs. And then we have a spike in the deep interval again. So we're perplexed. We're like, okay, why are we having this? And some thoughts were that it was possibly caused from back diffusion from primary porosity, or this is also the area where we had that surfacing occur. So here is MW59, and then here is the well where we had the surfacing occur. And we were able to get the full dose in there, but we couldn't put it in at the, you know, a high enough gallons per minute. So maybe we had an area where we didn't have coverage. So we installed another injection well, upgradient of it to replace it. And we were going to go ahead and re-inject in this barrier. And we did that because, number one, we were at the same time installing two other barriers. And so we were already out there. So it wasn't going to take much effort to re-inject in these wells. And the other thing is we wanted to be protective of the private supply wells down gradient. So this time on the design of these barriers here, we actually got some additional information to help us determine better well spacing. And what we did is we put in Enviroflux passive flux meters. And these passive flux meters, they measure time average cumulative contaminant mass fluxes and groundwater fluxes. And we did this for several wells for both the other two barriers that we installed. And we did it upgrading of the Stevenson, existing Stevenson barrier in MW61. And so these are the passive flux meters, and they are composed of granular activated carbon and a tracer. And these stack inside your well, and they have to fill the whole portion of the screen, and they're actually really tight in the well because they want the water to flow through them. They sit in the well for about 2 weeks, and then you pull them back out, and you can sample intervals within each of these passive flux meters. And for us, we did three intervals. So we broke it into three segments and sampled those three segments. And then we then EnviroFlex calculates the Darcy velocity and the PCE mass flux. And what was really interesting is this well that is upgradient of our existing Stevenson barrier, our Darcy velocity was 2 times faster than anticipated. So this also led to us using this information and the information we gained from all the injection activities to decrease the well spacing from 12 and a half feet now to 11 feet. Obviously, we couldn't do that with an existing barrier, but the new barriers were 11 feet apart, the well spacing. So in June 2020, we re-injected in the Stevenson Avenue barrier. We re-injected 47,000 gallons of plume stop water mix. So we were originally going to inject in only wells that were above the MCL on our baseline sampling that we had from the baseline sampling. Unfortunately, we had some issues with injection. Our injection rates were relatively low. They were 3.48 gallons per minute, and we had to keep the pressure below 50 PSI because we started surfacing, as you can see in that picture there. The surfacing was more extensive during the reapplication, and several wells could not take any volume. We totally lost well capacity. We were able to inject in most wells. And what we ended up doing was injecting in some of the wells that we weren't, that were below the MCL that we had not planned on injecting. And that way the design volume was applied. So what is the end result? Well, the end result ended up being good. So from October to December 2019, you can see our site map. That's when we had the high concentrations in GW207. And then here is our July to September 2020 concentrations, and we have successfully stopped the PCE contamination going through the barrier. So the results were good. Real quickly, I think I'll just go through some of the trend graphs for the Stevenson barrier. And this is your wells that are up gradient of the barrier and what's coming into the barrier. And then these are the wells that we use as performance assessment down gradient of the barrier. This is when we injected. This is the second injection. And you can see the concentrations came down relatively quickly. We had a little bit of a spike in that well that we talked about. And then now we're below the MCL. In addition, Regenesis does some modeling for the barrier. And they use a plume stop, plume force model. And this is an example of the model. This is what was done for MW59 for the 91 foot interval. I think that's the upper interval on this well. And this is showing, the model is showing is how concentrations are going to decrease as the water goes through the barrier. Model is competitive and dynamic. It predicts back diffusion and contaminant breakthrough, and it considers the following design parameters: groundwater velocity, contaminant mass flux, degradation rates, starter products, sorption dynamics, and retardation factors. Here now is the model with our data applied. So as you can see, the model actually predicted pretty well what our concentration trends were going to be. You need to note that it takes time to see observations because number one, our wells are 29, 30 feet away from the barrier. And that's because there's a road in the way. If we had wells closer, we would see the concentration trend drop more dramatically. Observed concentration trends reduced will be gradual due to the distance, and TCE and DCE influences observed before PCE influences are due to retardation factors. Here's the same model, and we've now taken it out. They've taken it out to the full distance to 2020, and the model is descriptive, it's predictive. It allows to anticipate data trends. It's qualitative and semi-quantitative. Performance monitoring should be allowed for data noise, and that would be kind of these little bumps along the way. And data noise should be validated through multiple events. You know, I would say we'd have concentrations be non-detected, and then we'd get a little rise, and I'd get a little excited. But even next time you'd sample, it'd be down. So, and so this is the model for 59 where we had the bump, and then this is the hole where we did the initial injection and the reapplication. And then we just want to say that, you know, this model was very beneficial, and the information was used. We used this model, and we also used the passive flux meters, the geophysical logs that we reviewed, to optimize our reapplication design. And that once we've done our reapplication, our performance data meets compliance with MCLs, and data is representative of all performance wells. And then kind of lessons learned. Well, I think kind of neatest thing was being able to see such, by installing all the wells really close together, you could really see the plume details. And it was not just at this site, but other sites that we were doing the same thing at. You know, if high resolution site characterization direct push tools cannot negotiate cemented sands, this level of characterization is costly to complete during a remedial investigation. The pilot testing, I think it would be important to do the pilot testing. I think it would also be important if you know you have differential cementation at a site, or you have fractures at a site, or differential permeability, it would be really useful to be able to do the pilot test in two areas, if you knew them, two different areas to see two different sides so that you could better design your well spacing. I think the geophysical logging was essential. It was very useful. It refined our screen intervals, and it focused treatment, and it reduced costs. Overpressuring during injection doesn't work. It slows our injection. You get back pressure, and you get surfacing. You kind of have to optimize what works best for your site for the injection, and you kind of do that in the first couple days of the injection. And then as you do more at a site, you can refine it as we did and come up with a specific plan. And I will say, when we did the subsequent injections with the knowledge that we had from the initial injection, it really made the subsequent injections much easier. Plume displacement following the injection resulted in temporary concentrations increases in our receptor wells. This happened at this site. And I guess we needed to be prepared for that. And thankfully we were, and we were monitoring on a close enough frequency that we were able to put a filtration system on that private supply well. And again, lessons learned from this first permeable reactive barrier were used for subsequent injections for additional barriers at this site and other sites with similar lithologies. And now we're happy to take questions, and we kind of have a panel for that can help us with questions, and I will let them introduce themselves, but we have Jay Snyder from EA Engineering, and we have Carlos Ortiz from Regenesis, and I'll let them both tell you a little bit about themselves.
Good afternoon. My name is Jay Snyder. I'm a geological engineer with EA Engineering, and I have been the senior hydrogeologist on this project for about a decade now. And have worked through the remedial investigation, through the feasibility studies and these remedial actions.
Hi, everyone. My name is Carlos Ortiz. I'm the district technical manager for Regenesis for the South Central District. And I'm one of many on our team that collaborated with Jay and Terry and at this site. So,
All right, thank you. So if it's okay with everybody, I think we'll launch into our brief Q&A period, and we do have a number of questions on the presentation. I'm gonna start first a little bit more background about the site. We've had a number of audience members who've asked Terry, where did the plume or the contamination originate from?
It originated, let's see if I can go back. So the original release, it was in this area here. It was a chemical plant.
Okay.
Excellent. I think I'd like to add too, Terry. I think of interest, they lost PERC, PCE was released, but there was also a release contemporaneous of a fairly significant volume of naphthalene. And so when we look at the groundwater solute plumes, there's in the source area, there's DCE and PCE and not much TCE. So I think that a significant amount of reductive dechlorination took place in the vadose zone at the release point.
Okay. And actually, there were a number of attendees who wanted to know if you were measuring or monitoring for VC at the site for vinyl chloride.
Yes, we have never had vinyl chloride at the site.
Okay.
And we did a little bit in our EVO barriers down gradient, but that was it.
Okay. All right, excellent. Several people had asked about bench or pilot testing, specifically before you applied or used the plume stop at the site. So can you talk a little bit again, or just revisit that concept of bench testing that you might've done before injection?
Well, bench testing we couldn't do because we couldn't core the rock. And pilot testing we could have done, and we opted not to do it at this site, but we did do it at another site. And the pilot testing, Carlos can kind of go into that, but we had to install multiple wells at various intervals and an injection well, and then they would come out and inject, and we would monitor water level measurements and see when plume stop arrived in a specific observation well, the time it took.
And yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Terry.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll just quickly add, so the specific contaminants of concern here, the isotherms and the sorption kinetics of those are well understood in relation to how plume stop would work at the site. So in terms of a pilot study, we often internally, we call it a design verification testing. We're really focused on the delivery, the distribution, the ROIs and injection pressures and volumes. So it's really fine tuning those aspects of the application.
Okay.
Well, and we also did that in the field at the very beginning of the injection. So like the first 2 days we sit there and we try different rates of injection. We observe how long it takes to come in contact with an observation well. So when we install the barrier, there's always an observation well close by so that we can actually inject near that well and verify that, yes, this is the correct radius of influence, and yes, that this is the injection rates we need.
Okay. Okay. And so I do have just a couple of questions along those lines. So one of the attendees wondered, did you see the injection pressure increasing during that injection period? And they were wondering if it was possible to conduct multiple injections in the same injection well if you needed it.
So yes, when we inject towards the end of the volume, the total volume that was prescribed for that well, our injection rates would slow and our pressure would increase.
Okay.
And we did a second application and we were able to re-inject in most of the wells. Some of the wells we could not re-inject in.
Okay. Okay. And then to confirm, the plume stop destroys PCE? I mean, and if not, they were wondering, is there a concern that the PCE would come back and be an issue for groundwater in the future?
Carlos, I'll let you handle that one.
Yeah, no, thank you. So plume stop itself does not have a destructive component. For this particular site, and I'll let EA comment on that, there was natural attenuation that was basically observed. I think Jay alluded to that earlier about that. So I think we had a good understanding of what the decay rates or the half-lives of the constituents were at the site. And so we used that to our advantage. Not every site is like that. So that's one of the aspects or parameters that we really track closely with the modeling that's done for these designs.
Okay. Okay. I have a couple of other questions, and one of the attendees, or actually I should take that back. I see two of them asking about models or simulations. So specifically, they wondered what you might have done in the way of a model or simulation to confirm that the PRB would work. And I really think what they're getting at is to understand subsurface hydrogeology. So what kind of modeling did you do to understand the subsurface, if any?
You want to take that, Carlos?
Well, so I think, and I'll be happy to answer that, but I think their question is more about any type of 3D modeling on the hydrogeology side of the design. I mean, this model that we use, it's really a tool for evaluating the like we talked about, the contaminant mass flux and whatnot, but it's not necessarily addressing distribution of the contaminant mass within the aquifer on a 3D level. So,
right, and with respect to that, I mean, you know, if you go back and look at some of the original plume maps between the supply wells and our monitoring wells, you know, we had really good control on the bounds of the plume in general. And what's interesting about these Cretaceous aquifers in Texas is that they're, you know, they're typically completed with fully penetrating wells, and they're not that thick of aquifers. And so the supply wells actually make pretty representative monitoring wells, which is often not the case with a pumping well. But in the case of these aquifers in Texas, we use them routinely as monitoring wells because they're quite representative.
Okay, excellent. I think we have time for just a few more questions before we begin wrapping things up. So we did have a design question. I take that back. I've got two. Someone wanted to know why you selected the 300-foot length for your barrier.
So the 300-foot length for the barrier was because that, if I go... If you look at the figure up right now, the 300-foot length of the barrier covered protecting the wells that were above the MCL, that could be above the MCL. We had no contamination here above the MCL or in these wells here. And so they picked this length here just to be protective of this area because that's where the bulk of the contamination was going through. We later added this additional barrier to be further protective. But at first, we just did the 300 feet. And we also wanted to see how effective the barrier was. You know, this was 2017 when BloomStop was first kind of coming out.
Okay. And then you had a great figure earlier in the presentation, Terry, that showed the barrier. It was like this arced hyphenated line. And one of the attendees noted that it looks like you're installing the PRB underneath buildings or foundations. And they just wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you managed to get it under the buildings, if that was the case, at least effectively under their foundations.
So are you talking about this drawing, this figure?
I believe, I'm still waiting to get back to the one that they're referencing.
So this was for horizontal SVE wells.
Okay.
So those were beneath the chemical plant.
Okay. Okay, those are horizontal wells. Okay. But nothing with the...
No.
Nothing with the PRB. Okay.
No. They were just vertical.
Okay. All right. And then let's try to sneak in one more question here. I think you hit on this earlier, but just to confirm, the 12-foot interval for those injection wells was selected, but those injection rates were varying dramatically along those barrier. And they just wanted to know what kind of groundwater testing you may have done before your injection Specifically, you know, do you know if that injection radius of influence is appropriate for those areas that had the low injection rate?
Well, we did the performance testing at the beginning with the observation well on that first barrier. Subsequent barriers that we installed had more observation wells along the barrier alignment so that we could test different portions of it.
Okay. Just
real quick, so I'll add, so Terry, I think she mentioned on the earlier on the application that the original design was based on the emulsified vegetable oil well spacing. In between that, which we had a preliminary design and our final design, we had done a pilot test application at a different site using plume stop where we were evaluating our radius of influences. And as the result of that, we came back to this design and reassessed the ROIs, and we reduced the spacing. We used that information to reduce the spacing to 12.5 feet. And then post application with additional information, we even, you know, closed the spacing just slightly to help with the application volumes and whatnot. So.
Okay.
And one other thing I'd like to add, you know, right to that question is, because of the differential cementation, we experienced, you know, different injection rates. And almost fortuitously, where we had difficulty injecting is lower permeability due to the cementation. And so those are not the high mass flux zones anyhow. Where we're able to inject in these, you know, Cretaceous aquifers in Texas, we've done several of them. Where you're able to inject is where your mass flux is going anyhow. One concern we have about some of these cemented zones is, you know, will we see perhaps a back diffusion issue out of some of these zones over time, in that they're not the high mass flux zones, but we could diffuse flux, you know, contaminants into them, which will then bleed out over time. So it's just the hand we're dealt. And it's also what makes bench scale testing difficult, because, you know, what material you're going to test, and can you get core, and can you even have a representative sample for a bench test, is complicated. We drill these holes air rotary, and what we get back is sand, because they're not strongly cemented, but they are cemented, and they do have a fracture permeability.
All right. Well, we are nearing our scheduled end time, so I think I'm going to draw a close to our formal Q&A period. Terry and Jay and Carlos, I want to thank each of you for taking time to share that presentation with us. And I'm going to walk through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. So I'm going to go ahead and turn on some final instructions here on the screen and go ahead and walk through these closeout messages. So the first thing I will do again is thank our presenters who took time to share their technical story today. And I want to thank the over 150 people who joined us for today's live session. If you are connecting early for session number 2, please stay with me. We'll get started with that here in just a moment. But I'll remind everybody that this is part of an ongoing webinar series that EPA is hosting with the Society of American Military Engineers. And so we have session number 1 for our May delivery that we've just concluded, and we'll carry on with session number 2 here in just a moment, but I encourage you to visit the DCHWS website to learn more about their events, as well as look at previously hosted ones and upcoming opportunities. And one of the other things that I wanted to be sure to point out is that the next set of webinars will take place on July 14th. We're going to do 2 more of these sort of back-to-back sessions, and I hope to have registration open very soon on the CLUIN website for these 2 sessions. Now, I encourage you to visit us at CLUIN and sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. When we get webinars open, we post them on CLUIN, and we'll be sure to include it on the Tech Direct monthly newsletter. So please be sure to connect with us there. Now, this is a website that may be of interest because some of you have asked for copies of the presentation material, along with how you can reach out to our presenters or share your thoughts on our session today. Remember, when you registered, you would have been pointed to the seminar homepage. It's listed at the top of this slide. That seminar homepage is active from today forward, so you can bookmark that and use it with the tabs on that page to learn more about our presenters, download their presentation materials, as well as access our online feedback form. And so you'll use that form form to let us know what she thought of our live delivery, both the content that was covered along with the webinar platform that we used to host the session. So please let us know what you think of Zoom webinar. We are definitely reading each and every one of your submissions, and we welcome your thoughts on our content and delivery mechanism. For those of you looking for a participation certificate, you can get one of those after submitting feedback, but please be sure to check the box at the bottom of the form that you were here for the whole session, and then fill in your email address. And as long as you do those two things, as soon as you submit feedback, you'll be able to download or print out a certificate like the one on the screen. If you happen to have multiple people join from your particular location, each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register individually. I'll simply ask whoever did register to be sure to get the following URL to those parties who joined you at your location so they can fill out the feedback form on their own and get their own certificate. And so with that, I'll go ahead and wrap things up for our first webinar.